if we could talk to the animals, learn their languages, think of all the things we could discuss. If we could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals, and they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to us! Of course, we learn from a really early age that we can talk to the animals, if only in fiction.
Mummy, will you read this to me?
Like Dr. Doolittle, who, of course, wants to help animals.
After a while, with the parrot's help, the doctor got to learn the language of the animals so well that he could talk to them himself and understand everything they said. Then he gave up being a people's doctor altogether.
And part of what we intend to do in our examination of what we call the Doolittle factor is to work out what effect long-term exposure to imaginary talking animals has on apes who really can use language, by which I mean us.
Everyone, when they're a child, has that Dr. Doolittle moment where they think, you know, if only we could talk to animals.
This is Penny Patterson.
Here was a chance. It was like there really was something sort of miraculous happening. Not quite like stepping on the moon for the first time, but it was that sort of feeling that some sort of bridge had been crossed. Someone really was communicating with an animal, and that animal was communicating back.
In Coco the gorilla's case, communicating in sign language with her human teacher, Penny. And later, we'll meet more apes, including human ones, with apparently amazing powers to communicate. But most language scientists say that in reality, we Homo sapiens alone are the only language-using animals on the planet, and that language has somehow become hardwired in us.
I think there's always going to be a limitation, a divide between what they're capable of achieving and what we would consider to be a real language. A limitation based on their biology, based on the constraints of their brain.
Is linguist Dr. Marcus Perlman, an expert in language and animals and a former companion of Coco the gorilla, right? Or is he a spoilsport, intent on defending at all costs this idea that the use of language is solely something that we human animals can do? A claim rooted in science, but not in culture. And if that debate sounds rather tiring, let's return to the simpler, cozier world of children's fiction and Eeyore from the Winnie the Pooh stories by A.A. Milne.
Sad. Why should I be sad? It's my birthday, the happiest day of the year. Your birthday? Said Pooh in great surprise. Of course it is. Can't you see? Said Eeyore. Look at all the presents I've had. He waved a foot from side to side. Look at the
Eeyore, lugubrious, pessimistic, not very bright, but somehow lovable in what seems an authentically donkeyish way, or so we suppose, until we meet real donkeys, which is what students from Exeter University are doing at Sidmouth Donkey Sanctuary, under the watchful eye of Carl Woolley, the sanctuary's education manager.
When we're in with the donkeys, ask yourself, how do you know? How do you know the donkey's happy? How do you know the donkey's sad?
I should say that these visitors aren't linguists or veterinarians. They're students of English literature. So decoding humans' fictional rendering of donkeys is part of the work. What we learn at the Donkey Sanctuary is that in reality, donkeys have always been much put upon beasts of burden.
If we're going to subject them to being these working animals, it's easier for us, I think, easier for our guilt and conscience to make out that they're not as aware.
Which is a shame, really, because our anthropocentricity distorts donkeys' real qualities, which include loyalty, as we learned at the sanctuary. There have even been stories of donkeys bonding faithfully with non-donkeys, including Shetland ponies and even chickens. And I personally have witnessed donkeys acting as guard animals, protecting sheep from coyotes in the northern states of America. But we prefer the untruthful stories of donkeys as stupid, miserable, and stubborn. whereas loyalty, that true donkey virtue, is more often assigned, of course, to dogs. And the tradition of the talking dog goes back 3,000 years to Aesop, as these English literature students will know because they've been studying animals in literature, particularly talking animals. Professor Jane Spencer of Exeter University runs the course, which starts with Aesop's parable of the dog and the wolf.
We've got a plump, well-fed dog who boasts to the wolf that he's got a master who gives him as much food as he wants. And the wolf is quite envious. And then the wolf asks, "What's that mark on your neck?" The dog replies, "Oh, that's where the collar that my master put on me made a mark. It rubbed against my neck." At which the wolf turns away and says, "Well, you can keep all the food your master gives you. I want my freedom. I'd rather have that than your slavery, however luxurious it is."
Now, we know that Aesop was almost certainly an enslaved person, and this parable is about human slavery, which was then as commonplace as wolves. But Dr. Spencer wants us to consider this as an animal story as well.
Actually, that says something very true about the difference between a dog, a domesticated animal, and a wolf, the animal from which the dog originally evolved. So as well as being about the costs and benefits of human civilization, you could say it's about the costs and benefits of domestication to animals. Are dogs better off than wolves?
Much harder to answer, unless you're a talking dog or a talking wolf. In which case, do write in.
I started to think, as a number of people have started to think, that literature ought to be interested in the animalities as well as the humanities. There have always been writers who would like to find out what animals are like in themselves. Whether we can get to that notion is another matter.
For the moment, let's stay in the world of the human imagination and works of fiction that empathise with animals. Horses, for example.
"And after a good deal of coaxing, he got the bit into my mouth, but it was a nasty thing."
In this case, one horse, Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
"Those who have never had a bit in their mouths cannot think how bad it feels. A great piece of cold, hard steel as thick as a man's finger to be pushed into one's mouth, between one's teeth and over one's tongue, and held fast there by straps over your head, under your throat, round your nose and under your chin."
Black Beauty, published in 1877, was a Victorian bestseller at a time when the working horse was commonplace and widely treated as a machine rather than a sentient being. The book succeeded both as a story and a humane campaign manual. Stable boys were encouraged to read it or have it read to them so that they would think of horses as feeling animals. And thanks to its humane message and its believable central character, horses benefited. Meanwhile, another animal has been shown to suffer because of our anthropomorphism of it in fiction. Our loathing of the hyena, who we imagine laughs over its prey, has had serious consequences.
Systematically, throughout history, the hyena has been represented as a character that is despicable and is not to be saved and is something that you don't want to associate yourself with.
This is Kynwen Ripley, one of the Exeter students on the donkey trail.
You have multiple instances of literature depicting the hyena as malicious, cowardly. The laughter of the hyena has been misinterpreted because it's anthropomorphised into human laughter when actually it's just a vocalisation. It has nothing to do with joy or laughter. There's been massive conflicts between hyenas and farmers, particularly in Africa, where the hyenas come into conflict with like cattle. And because of those conflicts, the hyena numbers are declining, as they are with multiple species. But in the same way that you have conservation efforts for other species, you don't have a similar conservation effort because of the way they've been interpreted by people globally.
However, we do feel close to our fellow apes for obvious reasons. Tarzan was famously and fictitiously raised in the jungle by apes. But I want to introduce you to a Tarzan spin-off character, Cheetah, the chimpanzee. You'll remember Tarzan and Cheetah chatting to each other in the films.
"Cheetah, what you drink? schnapps.
Manners, cheetah. In 2008, the comic actor chimpanzee, who played Cheetah for all those years, wrote a hilarious memoir about his 30 years as a minor Hollywood star. Well, to be truthful, the book was ghosted by a human writer called James Lever. Cheetah was given a word processor to see whether he could do the job himself, but he kept churning out The Tempest for some reason. A freighter full of kidnapped and caged African beasts bound for Hollywood. Amongst them, Cheetah and an arch baddie of the animal world, a snake. In this case, an escaped deadly black mamba, which was poised to strike a human deckhand, Gabe DeMarco. Cheetah recounts how, at the last moment, the burly DeMarco appeared to dodge the slithering serpent by staging a clever pratfall.
It was one of my discarded banana skins that DeMarco had stepped on, we later worked out. It had taken his legs from just under him at the moment of the mamba's strike. The crew ran over to the snake as it sprawled, somewhat surprised, or as surprised as a snake can ever look, and momentarily vulnerable. A couple of them managed to jam its head down against the deck with their wooden sticks, and with a long knife, Captain Manica decapitated it. And still, the snake's head and half a foot of its body continued to slither towards him. And we watched it, pleading with it to die so we could go to America. It did. But to this day, I have a loathing for two things in particular. Three, if you count Mickey Rooney. I fear snakes, and I cannot stand the taste of bananas.
Me, Cheetah. Literary chimpertainment at its best. And I wonder how much our love of books and movies and TV and tea parties and tea commercials, all full of talking apes, shapes our desire to talk to them. Biologist and psychologist Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, who went on to become a leading experimental scientist in ape language, traces her fascination with the chimpanzee world to some performers she saw as a child in the 1950s at the St. Louis Zoo.
And they did things like ride motorcycles through rings of fire and walk on stilts. And I was just taken aback and amazed. And I asked my father if I could go backstage and meet the people and the chimpanzees. So he arranged that. And when I got there, I wanted to see the chimpanzees not in the show and how they really behave. And I got to see the chimpanzees and meet the people. And they explained that they didn't really teach the chimpanzees. They showed the chimpanzees, and the chimpanzees became able to do the things just by watching what the humans did. So I reflected upon that, and after leaving the zoo at 5 years of age, I was conflicted as to whether I wanted to be a lion trainer or a chimpanzee trainer.
15 or so years later, Sue, now a psychologist, had her wish come true and found herself, as a graduate student, involved with ape language studies. Her job at the University of Oklahoma was to teach signs to a chimpanzee called Bowie in a rather mechanical way.
So I was asked to show a variety of signs to the chimpanzees and mold their hands into these signs and then slowly mold less and less and less and less, which is called shaping, to kind of shape away the need for me to show them the sign or put them through the motions of the sign. And the goal was you just hold up a key or a book or a knife or a Kleenex or whatever, and they would make that sign. It was rather boring for me, and it was rather boring for Bowie. So in between, I started tickling and playing with Bowie, and he started tickling and playing with me. And one of the things he loved to do was to hang upside down by his feet and then let me tickle him while he was hanging upside down. So I began to wonder, could he understand a sign if I made it that I didn't teach him? So I decided to move my hands around in a circular manner, my two fingers, because that represented the flipping over that I wanted him to do. So when he was hanging upside down after tickling him, I made that sign, and he smiled really big, and he just flipped over immediately and sat down. And I realized that not only did he understand it, he could learn it in one trial, and he could do it again when I asked.
Bowie was learning as a human child would learn language, not mechanically, but through natural interaction with an adult ape, albeit a human one. A few years later in New York City, a tiny chimp called Nim was being introduced into his new human family. This is Jenny Lee, who for a while was Nim's big sister.
He was taken away from his mother at about 10 days old or a week old, came to our house when he was about 2 weeks old, completely helpless little creature. The idea was that he would come and live with us, and we would all be talking in sign language, which none of us knew, and but that's sort of besides the point.
The aim of the adoption was to bring Nim up as a human and see how much language he could absorb, to challenge the scientifically popular notion that language was something only humans can do. The first thing he absorbed, though, was human breast milk. To begin with, Jenny's mother breastfed her hairy new stepson, little Nim.
She has three kids. I think what she was experiencing was him as an infant, and that his instinct was to be looking for a breast. You know, the bond that was being created between her and Nim was very intense. He was as human as, you know, any human child would be.
Becoming a part of Jenny's human family was all part of the experiment. He did what they did, which later meant smoking marijuana and using the lavatory. And he did learn to communicate.
He would ask for things. He used sign language. Remember, I'm, you know, 14, 15 at this time, so I'm not a scientist. I'm not trained. But what Nim was able to do was to sometimes control his behavior. So he would be angry like a toddler, and instead of running up to you and, you know, trying to bite you or hit you or grab something, he would use the sign for bite.
Meanwhile, in California, Coco the gorilla was increasing her sign language capacity with some success. Her soulmate, Penny Patterson, who we heard at the beginning of the program, noted that Coco talked not only about things, but feelings, like the feelings she had about her beloved pet cat, Ball, who had died.
After Ball died, she'd look at pictures of kittens, especially ones that looked like him, and say to herself, "That sad frown, cry."
And Coco appeared curious. Here she is with a visiting radio reporter in 1985, appearing to exhibit, by pointing to her lips, then at the reporter, a kind of empathy.
Lips, you. She's asking you if you're thirsty.
Oh, no, I just had some 7-Up.
Drink you. Yes, yes, she did. This isn't a drink. She's pointing to your tape recorder. This is a machine, Coco. There's no drink in there. Some people, like Barbara, bring her drinks in their purse, which this could, I guess, be construed as a purse. It has a shoulder strap. No drink in there.
But did Coco really learn and use sign language? In the videos, there's a lot of explanatory speech coming from Penny.
It's quite clear in the communication with Coco that she relies a lot on the spoken message.
Dr. Adam Shembri from Birmingham University is a linguist who specialises in sign languages as used by deaf people, and he takes a dim view of the claim that apes like Coco are using true, unadulterated language.
Because the signing is produced with speech. That's another thing that, you know, obviously is not part of American Sign Language. You don't produce it with spoken English. It's its own separate language that you produce.
In Coco's case, Penny's constant commentary might be unconsciously overstating Coco's capacity to communicate.
For example, half the time Coco doesn't seem to be looking at the person signing to them. She seems to be looking around the room or looking elsewhere. The signs don't seem to be as clearly articulated as you would expect. And certainly there doesn't seem to be any evidence of any kind of complex grammar being used in communication. So there's a whole range of features of a natural sign language that you just don't see in the communication, or at least the video clips and films that I've seen of communication between great apes and humans.
Verifying claims that these animals are truly using language is hard. For one of these projects to work, researchers have to develop close bonds with the animals. There's a danger of creating a private and therefore unverifiable mode of communication. Such may have been the case on Project NIM, which placed an infant chimp in a human family and established an expensive research team to investigate what level of language NIM could achieve. In 1979, 6 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars into the project, its founder, Herbert Terrace, dropped a bombshell on television.
I suddenly saw what the key to this was. Nim was a brilliant beggar, and he could work as teachers and always get what he wanted. And most of the time, he moved his hands in the ways that the teacher suggested. And the motive of his signing was not to say, "What a nice cat you have over there," but "I want it."
A string of signs is not necessarily a sentence. You can learn a list of words by rote, and that says nothing about your ability to use a grammar.
Aren't you very disappointed that you spent all this time and all this money?
Well, it would have been very electrifying news, almost like communicating with a creature from outer space, if I could show that another organism could use language the way humans have.
But it didn't work.
It didn't work.
Herb Terrace, ape language apostate, in an excellent documentary called Project NIM, directed by James Marsh. Sue Savage Rumbar chose the calmer-natured bonobos rather than chimpanzees for her project and sidestepped the sign language trap with an especially talented bonobo called Kanzi. She taught him to use lexigrams, hundreds and hundreds of abstract symbols that look very much like letters, each symbol corresponding to a word.
Could you listen again?
Kanzi acquired the dexterity of a touch typist, his sheets and hundreds of laminated lexigrams going wherever he and Sue went.
Could you pour a little Coke?
Kanzi developed a high degree of competence in understanding what was said to him by humans.
Thank you. That's enough. You can, okay.
The resulting videotapes, many available online, show some startling results. An example. Kanzi was asked to perform tasks involving things and actions that were deliberately unpredictable.
Could you take the TV outdoors?
To check he was really listening.
Could you carry the television outdoors, please?
Sue even wore a welder's mask in that video, so Kanzi couldn't pick up any facial clues to these random-seeming instructions. One day, she had to leave Kanzi, missing his birthday, to attend a conference.
So I said, "And when I get back, Kanzi, from this important conference where I'm going to talk about you, I'm going to bring you a really wonderful present." And of course, I kind of felt guilty, you know, I wasn't there for his birthday. So what does a partial step-parent do? They say they're going to bring something. So anyway, I got distracted at the conference. There were a lot of critics. I forgot Kanzi's present. So when I came back, which was, a week or two later, I went in to say hello to Kanzi, and he was absolutely livid. He was displaying, he was aggressive, he was screaming, and I had no idea what. I thought, have people mistreated him while I was gone? Is he just growing up and becoming adolescent and his hormones are kicking in? I had no idea why. So I sort of like slowly entered further into the room, you know, to show him that there's nothing to be mad at Sue about. And he just kept hitting the bars. And finally, I thought, what was the last thing I said to Kanzi? And I said, "Oh, you see that I've forgotten your present." And he immediately went, "Wah, wah, wah," and smiled and was ready to hug me because I understood his anger.
There is little in the way of happy ever after in these true stories of great apes learning to use language. Poor Nim finally bit someone seriously. Project Nim was abandoned, and the chimp found himself in a medical research facility, from which he was eventually rescued. Kanzi and Sue are separated, we hope temporarily. Coco the gorilla died in 2018, aged 46, at the Gorilla Foundation in California. In her later years, she had been the center of an odd lawsuit involving the alleged unfair dismissal of two workers. In 2005, Coco kept asking two female workers at the Gorilla Foundation to show her their nipples. They were told that if they, quotes, did not indulge Coco's nipple fetish, their employment with the Gorilla Foundation would suffer, end quotes, so the lawsuit claimed. They were eventually fired. Later, the matter was settled out of court. The moral, if we do teach language to animals, we must be prepared not to like what they say. Well, we started this investigation looking at what we can learn about talking animals in fiction.
Esteemed gentlemen of the Academy.
And that's where we return with an important story by Franz Kafka.
You show me the honour of calling upon me to submit a report to the Academy concerning my previous life as an ape. My memories have increasingly closed themselves off against me. As my development was whipped onwards, I felt myself more comfortable in the world of human beings.
In other words, the acquisition of human language denied this ape any retrospective insight into his apehood. Have we been doing this to apes all along? Over 60 years after they started, ape language experiments are dwindling in number. Ethically sourced baby animals are in short supply. Now, scholars are trying to study apes' modes of communication with each other in their natural habitat. But is animal communication in the wild language? Marcus Perlman.
I wouldn't call that language. I think they have a very sophisticated communication system using gestures and facial expressions and vocalizations and body postures and so on that is very good at communicating the kinds of things that bonobos need to communicate with each other. It isn't anything like what linguists would call language.
How could we know whether bonobos have a language of their own? It would be impossible to find out, unless... I propose an experiment. Taking the Doolittle factor, a desire to learn the native languages of animals in their own habitat, a little bit further. Step forward, anyone listening who has a newborn human baby, hardwired for language, as we all are, apparently, a newborn that they would like to place in the foster care of bonobo apes in the wild for a few years, purely in the interests of research, to become fluent in bonobo. You could call him Tarzan the Second. Anybody? Yeah, I thought not.